Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, John Russell, Ann Ball, and Pete Musto. Later, Ashley and I will bring you this week's lesson in everyday grammar. But first, the likely Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, has called for a ban on Muslims entering the United States. Earlier this month, in a speech the day after the worst mass shooting in modern American history, Trump said, "The bottom line is that the only reason the killer was in America in the first place was because we allowed his family to come here. That is a fact, and it is a fact we need to talk about." If such a ban had been in place in the 1980s, Imran and Amna Bashir would probably still be in Pakistan. Today, the Bashirs live in Northern Virginia. Imran and his son Danish work in the computer technology industry. His other son, Danielle, is studying to be a doctor of pharmacy at the University of Baltimore. At the Bashir home, Imran is cooking dinner while Danish talks with friends on social media about a television program that is popular with many young Americans. Imran told VOA he speaks to many people about his religion. One reason, he says, is because he is worried about how some politicians talk about Muslims. "We are a middle-class family. We want to just be normal people." His son Danish says he does not understand Trump. "I am still an American too, and being an American is about being together, so my view is different from his. His hatred of IS is correct, but pointing to people in your own backyard, that doesn't make any sense to me." Danish says he is lucky to live in a mixed neighborhood and have friends from many backgrounds. "There is no segregation in terms of that. It's equal opportunity, and that is what we have in America. We can come from nothing into becoming something great and achieving our goals. And that is why my parents came to America," he says. The Bashirs and other families show the reality of Muslims in the United States. More than 3 million Muslims live here. In fact, a recent Pew Research Center report predicted Islam will be the second largest religion in the United States by 2050. While some U.S. cities have areas that are mostly Muslim, the majority of Muslims live in mixed neighborhoods, like the one where the Bashirs raised their children. The Pew study also says a higher percentage of Muslims in the U.S. are better educated and earn higher wages than those who belong to most other religions. Yet some politicians describe a picture of Muslims in the United States as isolated and dangerous. Last March, after the terrorist attacks in Belgium, Senator Ted Cruz said, "We need to empower law enforcement to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized." Around the same time, Donald Trump began calling for a ban on Muslims entering the country. He suggested that the Muslim faith supports hatred and violence. Where this hatred comes from and why, we will have to determine, he said. Many legal and terrorism experts quickly called Trump's call for a ban on Muslims entering the U.S. unconstitutional and counterproductive. Seth Jones works at the RAND Corporation, a study group. He is an expert on terrorism. He says banning Muslims from entering the country is a waste of resources. Jones also says a ban against all Muslims does not deal with the cause of the problem. This isn't about Islam. This isn't about Sunni Islam. This is about a very small percentage of individuals who hold what we call a Salafi jihadist worldview to establish a global caliphate, he told VOA. In other words, Jones says a small, unusual group of Muslims wants the entire world to operate under a conservative Islamic government. Jones says a better solution than a ban on all Muslims is to ask those who oppose Islamic extremist violence to help identify people who might do harm. Anti-terrorism experts also note that politicians who speak against Muslims actually help the Islamic State group. Lorenzo Vedino works at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at the George Washington University. The message ISIS sends out to Muslims is that the West hates you. The West is at war with Islam. You do not belong in Western society, he says. As a result, says Vedino, Muslims who used to feel at home in the U.S. may decide to support the Islamic State and act against their country.
The U.S. Supreme Court says the University of Texas can consider race when deciding which students to admit. The case was one of the most closely watched because it deals with the issue of affirmative action. Affirmative action is a policy designed to help those who suffer from discrimination, especially regarding employment or education. The decision has nationwide implications because other American universities use similar affirmative action policies. However, 8 U.S. states do not allow race to be used when considering public college admissions. The states are Arizona, California, Florida, Michigan, Nebraska, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, and Washington. By law, the University of Texas guarantees admission to students who graduate in the top 10% of their high school class. But when considering applications from about 25% of students, the University of Texas also considers the student's race, along with other factors. The 4-3 Supreme Court decision means the university's admissions policy can remain. Abigail Fisher, a white woman, filed the case against the University of Texas. She said the school denied her admission based on her race. Fisher's grades were not good enough to get her automatic admission under the top 10% rule. She was denied admission to the University of Texas in 2008. When she found out that minority students with lower grades than hers were accepted, she sued the school for discrimination. The University of Texas said Fisher would not have been admitted with or without race as a factor. The university says its race-based selection policies are necessary to maintain a diverse campus community. Fisher's attorneys argued that the top 10% program is enough to make sure that adequate minority students are included in the admissions process. Justice Anthony Kennedy gave the majority opinion for the court. The university has thus met its burden of showing that the admissions policy it used was narrowly tailored, he wrote. Kennedy also said that it remains an enduring challenge to our nation's education system to reconcile the pursuit of diversity with the constitutional promise of equal treatment and dignity. Three other judges, Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Samuel Alito, and Justice Clarence Thomas, disagreed. Alito said he thought the decision was an example of affirmative action gone berserk. He said he felt the university had relied on a series of unsupported and noxious racial assumptions. In a separate dissent, Thomas expressed his view that the U.S. Constitution makes it illegal to use race as part of the admissions process in higher education. U.S. President Barack Obama praised the Supreme Court's decision for upholding the basic notion that diversity is an important value in our society, and that this country should provide a high-quality education to all our young people, regardless of their background. I'm Brian Lynn.
Many of the 285 million people who have vision problems live in low-income countries, according to the World Health Organization. The WHO says most people with vision problems could be helped or cured, but only if they can get the right treatment. Enter Orbis and its Flying Eye Hospital. The nonprofit organization has a plane that is also a state-of-the-art eye clinic. The plane allows medical workers to perform vision screenings and operations around the world. Orbis has the world's only flying eye hospital. This June, it introduced its latest model, a MD-10 airplane donated by the FedEx company. It is the third version of the Flying Eye Hospital. Dan Neely of the Indiana School of Medicine is a volunteer doctor for Orbis. He has traveled to Jamaica, Southeast Asia, and Africa on the new plane. He says this plane has all the newest technology. Some facilities on the ground do not. You can be in Zambia and the power goes out in the middle of the surgery, Neely said. You can be there needing to scrub your hands for the surgery, and you have to use a bucket of water because the water's gone out. The CEO of Orbis is Bob Rank. Rank is a retired U.S. Air Force Brigadier General. Rank explained that the new plane also includes a classroom. Orbis uses the room to train doctors and nurses in the countries where it lands. He said Orbis teaches local healthcare providers to make it a priority to reduce cases of blindness. Gary Dyson is a pilot who usually flies cargo planes for FedEx, but he volunteers flying time for Orbis. When you see a child who can't see on Monday and they can see on Wednesday, you're hooked, Dyson said. The change in a patient's life after surgery can be dramatic, said Rosalind Stevens. Stevens is a volunteer doctor from the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. When we remove the patch the next day, the patient breaks into a big smile, she said. The newest version of the flying hospital will make flights to a few cities in the United States. Then it will provide a medical program in China in September. Orbis also operates programs in Cameroon, Ethiopia, Ghana, China, Vietnam, India, Bangladesh, Indonesia, and Latin America. I'm John Russell.
An airplane powered totally by the sun landed in Seville, Spain, early Thursday after completing a 71-hour flight across the Atlantic Ocean. The plane, a Solar Impulse 2 model, has just one seat. It left from John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York Monday morning. This was the plane's 15th stop in its planned around-the-world trip. The trip began in Abu Dhabi in March of 2015. Swiss aviator Bertrand Piccard operated the solar-powered plane on this leg of the tour. The Solar Pulse 2 had an average speed of 70 kilometers an hour during his flight. The plane's power comes from 17,000 solar cells built into the wings. The cells capture the sun's energy, which is stored in batteries on the plane. The Solar Pulse 2 has a 72-meter wingspan. That is longer than the wingspan of a Boeing 747 passenger plane. The solar-powered plane weighs about as much as an automobile. Piccard's friend and business partner, André Borschberg, will operate the plane on the final part of the trip. He plans to fly from Seville to Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. I'm Anne Ball. We'll be right back.
U.S. congressional Democrats have been demanding that the House of Representatives votes on gun control legislation. The Democratic Party lawmakers began the protest on Wednesday. Congressman John Lewis of Georgia asked House Democrats to join him in a sit-in on the House floor to force a vote. Lewis was active in America's civil rights movement and took part in nonviolent sit-in protests half a century ago. The protest on the House floor continued through the night and into Thursday afternoon. Lawmakers held up pieces of paper with the names of gun violence victims. They spoke about the country's need for stronger gun control measures. Republicans in the U.S. Senate rejected four proposed gun measures earlier this week. The four bills were offered after the deadliest mass shooting in American history. 49 people died in the attack at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. The House of Representatives was supposed to suspend work this week until after the 4th of July, a U.S. government holiday. But angry Democrats demanded that the House vote on gun control bills before it closed for Independence Day. They shouted, "No bill, no break." The hashtag "No bill, no break" trended for more than 24 hours on Facebook and Twitter. The Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, ordered that television cameras on the House floor be turned off. Without cameras recording their protest, the lawmakers turned to social media live streaming tools like Facebook Live and Periscope to film the protest. After the cameras were turned off, the congressional television channel, C-SPAN, began showing the lawmakers' Facebook Live videos of the protest on TV. And Periscope created a channel for users to watch all of the No Bill, No Break videos. The House officially adjourned on Thursday, without voting on gun control measures. Lawmakers will return to work after the 4th of July holiday. John Lewis spoke to reporters after he and the House Democrats ended their protest Thursday afternoon. "The fight is not over," he said. "This is just one step." I'm Pete Musto.
In this week's episode of Everyday Grammar, we are going to discuss the relative pronouns who, that, and which. A relative pronoun relates to the noun it is describing. Relative pronouns introduce a relative clause. Think of relative clauses as long adjectives. Adjectives are words that describe nouns. Let's start with an example sentence. The woman who called me yesterday was my mother. In this sentence, who is the relative pronoun, and who called me yesterday is the relative clause. The clause is describing the noun woman.
In general, the relative pronouns who, that, and which do one of two things. 1. They help identify the noun, or 2. They help give more information about the noun. In the example sentence, the clause, "Who called me yesterday?" identifies the noun, in this case, woman. When a relative clause adds more information about the noun, the clause is surrounded by commas. Here is an example sentence. My mother, who called me yesterday, says she is coming to visit me this summer.
Who is just one example of a relative pronoun that you can use when talking about a person. Let's listen to a scene from the comedy film Bridesmaids for another example. In this scene, the main character Annie is telling her best friend that she has changed. Listen for the relative pronoun.
Lillian, this is not the you that I know. The you that I know would have walked in here and rolled your eyes and thought this was completely over the top, ridiculous, and stupid.
The relative pronoun Annie used in the scene is that, when she says, the you that I know. In this sentence, that I know describes the noun you.
Both who and that can be used in relative clauses that describe a person. That can also be used to describe a thing. For example, the bike that I bought last week was stolen. The relative clause, that I bought last week, describes the noun bike. The relative pronoun which is also used to describe a thing. Here is an example sentence using which. My bike, which I bought last week, was stolen. In this example, the relative clause, which I bought last week, adds more information about the noun bike. The clause is surrounded by commas.
Here are some general rules about commas and relative clauses. If the clause begins with the relative pronoun that, you do not need commas. If the clause begins with the relative pronoun which, you generally need commas. If the clause begins with the relative pronoun who, you need commas if the clause is adding additional information about the noun.
Here is an example sentence using the relative pronoun who with and without commas. 1. My sister who lives in New York bought an apartment. 2. My sister who lives in New York bought an apartment. In the first sentence, the relative clause who lives in New York is identifying the noun sister. The speaker might have more than one sister. The clause, who lives in New York, is identifying which sister he or she is talking about. In the second sentence, the same relative clause is adding additional information about the noun sister.
Sometimes English speakers remove the relative pronoun altogether. Listen for the relative clauses in Shania Twain's song, You're Still the One. In one line, she keeps the relative pronoun that. In the rest, she omits or removes the relative pronouns. If the relative pronouns that and who are followed by a noun or pronoun, they can be omitted. That makes the sentences, you're still the one that I love, and you're still the one I love, both correct.
We can talk about other relative pronouns in another episode of Everyday Grammar. But for now, listen for the relative pronouns as we end this episode with the David Bowie song, The Man Who Sold the World. And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.